Ben, do you want to know a secret?
Yeah, go on.
I've been in my pants this whole time. Ben, I've been on a retreat. I am one with nature.
Okay, so we're going to jump right into it.
We're doing it now. This is it.
Okay.
Yeah, I went to a silent meditation and hill walking retreat.
Yeah, so we did mention this briefly on a previous episode that you were going to go and do this. So, yeah, fill us all in with the details. Remind us, where have you been? How long did you go for?
Yeah, but I know, you want to laugh at this. You want it to be a funny little thing.
No, I'm being very open-minded about this. I'm excited to hear how you got on with it.
I was open-minded, Ben.
Were you so open-minded your brain fell out?
So the first couple of days, right, it was a silent retreat. The middle 3 days was silent.
Okay.
And then the 2 days either side of that were just kind of getting used to, like, slipping into it and then coming out of it.
So were the 2 days either side of it particularly loud then?
Oh, no, they were pretty chill. Okay. It wasn't like, get out of your system. Yeah, had to get used to getting up at 6:30 in the morning. And then 2 hours of meditation in the morning. And then you have a short little break. Another 2 hours. Lunch. No, hang on. Breakfast before that second 2 hours. Then lunch. Then more meditation. Then chill, doing your own thing for a bit. Supper. More meditation. And then bed.
Okay, so let's just rewind a minute though. So what's the marketed idea behind this? What do they say on their marketing spiel about this? Why should people go away and do this? And why did you go away and do this?
If you're into meditation or Buddhism, the idea is to kind of take your practice deeper. So whatever you're trying to achieve through meditation, it allows you to kind of do that to a much deeper extent.
Is that what it says on the brochure?
No, well, they're a Buddhist organization. So retreats are kind of part and parcel of Buddhism. So it's not so much they have to advertise it, because it's like you seek them out if you want to have some time to take your practice deeper. But what I didn't realize, I thought, is that hill walking and meditation, I was like, brilliant. It said this is not an introductory retreat, but it also didn't say that you needed to be a fully-fledged Buddhist for it. Wow. So I get there. Going around the group, like, okay, everyone, just introduce yourselves to the group. Tell us a little bit about yourself. So first of all, my anxiety was going through the roof, because I'm like, I was the last person to have to talk. So it's working its way around. I'm like, you know the adrenaline when you need to talk. And I was like, okay, should I be funny? I don't know. And everyone was from what they call a sangha, which is like the Buddhist word for congregation.
Right.
Everyone had their own group. It's like, I am from the London sangha. I like to take my practice deeper, and just using all these Buddhist terms I didn't understand. So I was just in this impending doom of, oh, shit. I'm not from a sangha. I'm from Liverpool. But then and it's Triratna Buddhism, which is brought over to the UK by this guy, Sangrashita, something like that.
Right.
Back in the 60s. So it's like, I'd only been to a Zen Buddhism place. It's a bit like being an Anglican in a Catholic church.
Yeah, but surely there's not any blood there. I mean, Buddhists...
You say that, but I was just like, oh, well, I've had a bit of experience with Zen Buddhism. I don't know if that's like, if that's the wrong thing to say. And everyone was like, ooh. So off to a good start. Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you were a paying customer, right? So they can go shove it up their behind if they think that much about it, right?
Well, you say this, but they operate on dana, which is the word for kind of giving.
Right.
So you have a booking fee, and once you've paid that, you don't actually technically have to pay any more than that. So they have a suggested donation.
Okay. Right.
So it's not a money making thing. So for 29 years, they've gone on this basis of paying what you are able to. Some people say more. Some people pay more. Some people pay less.
Okay.
And it's worked for 29 years. So interesting. Seems to be going well.
It almost sounds like you're joining a cult.
It did feel like that. There was this other guy there. His wife bought him this retreat as a Valentine's present, so we kind of felt obliged to go. So me and him were kind of, fish out of water.
Yeah.
And quite often there were moments when all these candles would come out and everyone starts assembling. You think, okay, when's the goat coming out? When does the orgy begin?
Is this all going to get a bit eyes wide shut in a minute?
Yeah. The ritualistic aspects I was very uncomfortable with.
What do you mean?
So like whenever we had a meditation, you go into the shrine room.
Okay.
And there'd be...
Wait. Was this not just like a hotel or something? This was an actual dedicated place for this thing, right?
No, this is a retreat centre.
Oh, wow. Definite cult stuff.
In the Scottish Highlands called Dana Kosha.
Okay, okay. So what were the rituals?
Yeah, so like you like light candles, you like offer fruits, and you like give it to, usually there's a statue of the Buddha, but we had a statue of this, I don't know what you call it. It's called Tara.
Okay.
It's not a deity. It's not a god. So I didn't get this. I was like, right, Buddhism to me isn't about,
you're not
worshipping something. And so I said to the guy, you know, because he offered these little one-on-one things to discuss stuff. And I was like, I don't feel comfortable bowing, because everyone bowed to Tara when they came in. And I was there looking like shifty eyes, like, I'm not bowing to Tara. And so, yeah, I asked him and he said, it's kind of, she represents fearlessness, just the idea of it. So when you're bowing to it, you're bowing to fearlessness in yourself, not Tara. So I was like, okay, that's cool. Because he said Buddhism grew up around, you know, 2,500 years old. And he said it came about during, when people, you know, in pre-literate times, when people couldn't read.
Yeah.
And so, like, personifying these values in something which is quite understandable and visual was a way to, learn Buddhist teachings. And okay. I was like, okay. So it's not just weird cultish ritual stuff.
I could see why you'd be quite conflicted, though, because my understanding of you going into this, it was more about the actual, like, the mindfulness aspect of it rather than the actual religious side of it. You never spoke about that before.
Yeah, but I think I've been turned to the philosophical side. So with mindfulness, it's purely the practice side. It's like you're doing all the practice, but none of the philosophy behind it. But I think Buddhist philosophy and meditation help each other. So when you're meditating, you kind of have these insights into, like, okay, when I look at a tree, I'm calling it a tree, but really the idea of a tree is just a concept I've kind of created. Looking at the tree as it is and experiencing, okay, I mean, I can't describe a tree without using words and concepts, but seeing it as it is, that is something which can be described quite well by Buddhist philosophy, even though you can experience it during your practice.
I'm struggling to pull the two apart here. So mindfulness and Buddhist philosophy. I don't really understand how those are two.
So obviously meditation is a huge part of Buddhist practice.
Yeah.
And by meditating a lot, you're supposed to bring yourself closer to, you know, awakening to see reality as it truly is. Mindfulness has kind of been ported from Buddhism as kind of like a very hands-on, westernized way of meditation. But it strips away all the Buddhist aspects of it.
So what are you missing out on? So I know that the Western world's kind of caught up to this whole meditation thing. It's quite a big commercial enterprise as well. There's a bunch of apps out there and things like that. But what is missing from the Western view of mindfulness and meditation that the Buddhist philosophy offers?
I'll try and give an example. Yeah, it's like this conceptual framework that we put around experience as you're experiencing it. So I was reading in this book, and it's like saying when you're listening to sounds, you know, you'll hear a bird, and you in your head you think bird noise, and you put a direction in it, and you imagine where it is, and you start thinking about it. And it says you need to put effort into thinking about it as like a raw experience. And so then you go back to your practice. Hang on, this could be mindfulness as well, actually.
I think we've lost about half of our four listeners at this point.
We can cut this, Ben. You can cut this.
No, it's definitely interesting. It's just all of this sort of stuff so difficult to kind of conceptualize in your head, right? I mean,
all right. Here's the way I put it. So when I was reading a lot of Buddhist books in between meditation, and quite often I was reading stuff that I didn't quite understand, and I'd meditate and be like, okay, now I see what they mean by doing meditation. Yeah. And then by meditating, I would have other insights, and I would read and be like, oh, okay, that's kind of what I was thinking then.
Okay. So on the risk of going off totally on the deep end here, maybe we'll steer away from the higher philosophical questions that are associated with this trip.
Yeah, props for the best.
But I'm still curious, though. So what are your feelings about the whole Buddhism thing after accidentally walking into a Buddhist retreat, which is kind of heavily religious by the sounds and certain aspects?
I think I'm fully on board. The sticking points for me, like with Christianity, the sticking points are kind of the existence of God and heaven and hell. They're pretty big ones.
Yeah.
You kind of need those to be a Christian. And for Buddhism, it was karma and reincarnation.
So I'm not familiar with the whole Buddhist thing. I'm very naive when it comes to these things.
All right, should I try and just summarize it?
Kind of, I suppose. But like, so yeah, you're right with the whole Christianity and many of the modern religions. It's all about judgment and a higher being, and you know, surrendering yourself to this higher being and whatnot. So my understanding of Buddhism is that there's no higher being and there's no sort of judgment from a higher being. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, it's kind of all based around the subjective experience. So the idea is that experiencing reality as it really is, whatever that means to you, is being happy. Everything that we surround ourselves with, unhappiness comes from things that we've added on by not experiencing. So, and then Buddha was awakened a few thousand years ago and tried to set up this these rules and these paths by which to follow to achieve what he achieved. So you know, you've got the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. The Noble Truth is just like acknowledging suffering exists, and some other ones I can't remember. And then the Eightfold Path is just how to achieve enlightenment.
Okay, heavy stuff.
But yeah, karma, right? Karma isn't, if you do something bad, bad things will happen to you.
Yeah.
Good karma and bad karma. So good karma is something which, any action which brings you closer to enlightenment. So if you do a good deed towards someone, that improves your sort of loving compassion, and that helps bring you closer to enlightenment. So it's good karma in that it helps you closer to that goal, and bad karma is the opposite.
See, from like a, I don't know, a metaphysical point of view or a spiritual point of view, I think the notion of karma is ridiculous. That's as if to say, if you're good, the universe will look after you. But I think on an actual practical level, if you're generally good or if you're a generally bad person, the people around you and the situations around you will treat you as such. I think that makes sense, but I don't think there's any sort of like...
Yeah, but it's not about some magical cosmic interplay where your action magically comes back to you. It's about... If you do a bad thing, you will feel bad, and so it has negative consequences. And but feeling bad and having worries and regrets, like if you killed someone, that would be in your mind constantly and would make you feel negative, and that makes it very difficult to get to a position where you can kind of be enlightened or be more awake.
I guess what I'm trying to get at here is the actual Buddhists, do they believe in the whole universe is guiding you and changing the situations and experiences you have based on how good of a person you are?
Or no, that's what I'm saying. They don't.
They don't, okay.
It's a metaphor. Okay. It's like good karma brings you closer to enlightenment. And not because...
Okay.
It's not like the butterfly effect.
Yeah, okay. But when they say... When you say that that's what they believe in, is that the modern interpretation of all these things? Just like, you know, you look at like Christianity and whatnot, there's a bunch of things in the Bible which, like, you can't eat shellfish and stuff like that, and they're just like, don't worry about that bit. Is that the same with this, in that actual traditional Buddhism would?
I think the original Buddhist texts talk about it in the subjective sense.
Yeah.
And I think there are people that believe, oh, I do a good deed, it'll come back to me, but that's not what it means.
Okay. Whew, yeah. A pretty intense start to the podcast there.
Got some good old zingers in there.
Yeah, bloody hell. Wow. Okay, let's bring it back down to earth, shall we, and actually just talk about the trip itself. And
but yeah, honestly, hands down, after I did it, I've like haven't felt that happy in years. You can sort of disagree with the Buddhist teachings and what you do, but I think meditating and being close to nature, I just felt amazing.
Okay, I guess... The only question that comes into my mind is why? Why do you feel amazing? What from the experience makes you feel amazing?
So like, yeah, I don't know how to answer that. So the whole time you're trying to cultivate this sense of awareness, like surrounded by amazing scenery, you've got a beautiful loch, and so we spend as much of our time as possible meditating around that, you know, thinking about the water, thinking about what's around you, and every time an external thought comes in, you know, you sort of sit with it and let it go. Or if it's an uncomfortable thought, you kind of try and inspect it curiously and think about it. And the idea is that eventually it's foundationless and it disappears. And so by doing that consistently for a week, you kind of bring all any outside influence which will negatively affect you, you either deal with or come away from. And so it's like I was trying to say before, like normal experience should be just entirely happiness. and then everything else that we put on top of it, that's what causes bad experiences and anxiety and stuff. Like, you tell me a situation. There's situations where you're in pain, where you're it just is what it is.
So but what you've just said there is that our normal experience should be happiness. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's like, if you strip it all the way back, right down to foundations.
But why should it be happiness?
It's not whether it should or it shouldn't. That's just the way it is. Name me a bad experience. Like, if you're sat there and you're bored.
Yeah.
Bored is a form of craving. You crave activity.
Yeah.
But that's the craving. You're not doing nothing. You're craving. And so Buddhism would say you sit with the craving and think about the feeling, and ultimately it's baseless. And it's easier said than done. But yeah. You can lose that feeling, and then being there in the moment doing nothing can become enjoyable.
So they're basically saying that when you're bored, you don't have to action upon that. You just have to sit there and think about why you're being bored and cast it aside, and you'll no longer be bored. I don't really get that. It doesn't really gel with me.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. So I've been reading a lot of Buddha stuff, and I was got caught in some really cold rain, just a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And so ordinarily, like, you feel the cold rain, you're like, bloody hell, this is horrible, and you're feeling it, and you're like, you just want to get away from it and get warm.
Yeah.
But I was like, right, I'm just going to sit with this feeling of cold, kind of put it in the center of my attention and think about it, like, what does that feel like? What am I feeling? And suddenly the sort of painful aspect of it went, and it just became a feeling, like someone touching you. So it's like that, you can do that.
But physically you're still wet and cold, though. The fact that you're kind of trying to emotionally encapsulate it and deal with it that way, it doesn't change the actual, physical nature of it.
But this is the crux of the difficulty of explaining subjective experiences like this, is that saying it and understanding it is one thing, but experiencing it is different. So I would agree with you, but also having sat with that experience and thinking about it, it's a bit like when you have a food you don't like, and you have it more and more, and you start to like it, but it tastes exactly the same. So I'd say the same thing with the cold. It felt the same, but it no longer became unpleasant. It just became an experience through paying attention to it.
God, it really does sound like you're floating 3 inches off the ground. I'd love to not have to buy a waterproof jacket and just have to think about it intensely, and I'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's going to have negative consequences. I'm going to like catch a cold and feel bad, but you sit with it and it suddenly changes the experience.
Yeah. I'm still having trouble conceptualizing this, but I think that's kind of expected from 20 minutes worth of conversation. I don't think you could fully expect anyone to completely understand the concept, right?
So what are your views on mindfulness and meditation? Do you just think it's not for everyone? Doesn't work for you?
I mean, we spoke about this briefly in the past, well, many times, haven't we? But I just don't know. I mean, so you, for example, you give two examples there. If you're bored, you can kind of use the power of the mind to get over that boredom. But to me, all emotions are actionable, like with actual activity, not just sitting there trying to conceptualize it in your head and understand why you're feeling that way and trying to...
True, but one of the Four Noble Truths is that some suffering is unavoidable. And so I think, it's not to say that Buddhists just sit around doing nothing because they don't have to. If something is actionable, do something about it. But if you can't, sit with it and meditate about it and become comfortable with it, because, your perception is the only thing that you can change.
Yeah.
Because I'm very a skeptical person. So when I first heard about meditation, I was like, okay, that's very hippie-ish. But then, I look at the science behind it, and it changes certain structures of the brain. And although it's very difficult to objectify happiness, like, I think people who self-report as happy, they have these different, different brain structures and stuff. And, there's ways you can sort of show that it's making a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's the last big medical mystery is, well, one of the last big medical mysteries, at least, is how the brain works. And we don't fully understand all of the neural pathways and what creates them and how we can influence them and things like that. So I guess there is this element of the unknown when it comes to science around consciousness and whatnot. And, maybe that, like, things like Buddhism and meditation and stuff like that, maybe we're just scratching the surface and maybe, you know, it's 99% rubbish, but then there's that 1% which makes a big difference and things like that. It's hard to understand the effect.
Yeah, and it's hard to put into words, because your subjective experience isn't conceptualized. You just experience it. And in order to tell me about what you've experienced, you need to put it into concepts I can also understand. But by putting it into concepts, you're imposing limitations on the meaning of that.
Woo!
So if you see a bird, you could write down in words what the bird looks like, and I would get a very limited understanding of what it meant. Or you could take a picture, and I would have an even better understanding.
Yeah.
There's limits to what you can share with me. And so when you're trying to talk about meditation and mindfulness and talking about subjective experience, it's like, there's a limit to how much you can put that into concepts.
Yeah.
Good joke.
What a zinger. Okay, well, let's just, like I said before, let's bring it down to earth a little bit more. So the actual trip itself, you spent 3 days not talking. What was that like? Just from a pure, you know, relatable experience point of view.
So it was all so awkward sometimes. So, you know, there's 30 people on the retreat.
Yeah.
At breakfast time, all sat around, clinking cutlery and, like...
Yeah.
So I was just sitting there thinking, this is so surreal.
Yeah. Was there any non-verbal communication during those 3 days?
Oh, yeah. Like, there's a lot of, like, smiles and... So, and I went swimming every day in the morning.
Yeah.
So I went up to people, I did this little swimming gesture, like, you want to go for a swim? And then most people just shake their heads and laugh. But then some people will come along.
So you are allowed to laugh and things like that then, right?
Yeah, and it's funny you say that, because there was this guy, Steve, from the Wirral, and another girl, Aileen, from Scotland. And I came, they were just giggling during the middle of the silence, and I came and sat next to them, and I was just like looking at them, shrugging my shoulders like, what's the big idea? What are you guys laughing about? You know, when other people are laughing, you just pick up on it, and so I started laughing as well. But then, meanwhile, you've got people walking through, like, super silent and serious faces, you know, really deep in their practice, which just made it so much more funny. And that, we must have been hysterics for, like, 20 minutes. But oh, so, it was funny.
What's the actual purpose behind the not talking bit? Is it just to take it a step further? Is that all it is, or...?
Right, yeah, so if you're having a conversation with someone, you're talking about something, and then you're going to start thinking about that something.
Yeah.
And that something isn't in the present, and it's going to take you out of the present, and you'll stop... focusing on the present moment. So it's like the idea of not talking, it's just to minimize any opportunity to think about something which isn't here and now.
But you're still surrounded by a physical world that'll remind you of all these things anyway, right? I mean, you go down to breakfast and you think, what am I going to have for breakfast? And you're thinking about those objects around you and how much milk's left. And
generally when you think about the things around you, you just try and think about them as they are. So you see the porridge and you're like, okay, I'm looking at the porridge, but you don't think, I wonder where porridge comes from. You don't go off somewhere else.
Okay, so you try and rein it in a bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
But I tell you what was annoying. You know, there was like all these condiments. What do you call them? Spreads. Jams and spreads in the morning. I'm on the other end of the table. So I point to it like, oh, can you pass the jam? But I'm just pointing. And then they lift up the Marmite like, oh, no. Peanut butter. Oh, no.
Oh.
But then you have a little laugh. You just little smile at each other, just like, oh... Is it going to be this one?
Yeah, I could see that being annoying. So you do your 3 days, yeah? And then you do another 2 days where you're talking afterwards, right?
Yeah.
What was it like after 3 days of not talking to then start talking again? What was that like?
Well, it's really weird because we went on all these hill walks, because it was like a hill walking meditation retreat. And then during them, you kind of get to know people even though you're dead silent. So you kind of share all these moments. Like there was this one time where we were getting near the summit of this mountain, and then literally just over the summit we saw these deer.
Yeah.
And they turned around, looked at us, and then ran away. And so you kind of like tap people on the shoulder like, oh my god, look at the deer, but with your eyes. And then so what was I going to say? Yeah, so you come out of it and you feel like you know these people, and so you have these conversations like, hey, remember that time we saw those deer?
But that's not particularly influenced by the fact that you weren't talking. You could still do the exact same thing if you were talking, right? I mean, I don't really understand how that, you know...
I don't know what you mean, mate.
Well, just because you weren't talking doesn't mean that moment was any more poignant, right? You could still have that moment and still reflect upon it with someone else if you were talking at that moment in time, right?
That's true, but I think because we weren't talking, we were more receptive to those nice little moments.
Okay. Okay. Because you were so bored and you had nothing else to do.
Bloody hell, look at all this grass and this boy. Oh my God, it's a deer.
No, I'm only messing. And you also said you did a lot of swimming, a lot of hill climbing, early starts.
Yeah, man. Lost 2.5 kilos.
Yeah, 2.5 kilos, man. That's pretty good for a week. That's bloody good, in fact.
Yeah. It stayed off as well.
Yeah. Because you said you were eating vegan as well while you were there, right? What was the food actually like? Any good?
Oh, there was this girl, woman called Sue who came. And I as soon as it came out of silence, I was like, Sue, thank you so much. Your food's amazing. Because the food just became the highlight of my day. Like, I'd be sat there meditating, okay, thinking, lunch is pretty soon.
Well, that's not very Buddhist, is it?
It was all vegan, but it was so good.
So one of the people who came along actually prepared the food each day then?
Yeah, so she comes along to a few of the retreats. I'll just tell you, she volunteers.
Oh, okay. And what sort of food was it? Like, I know it was vegan, but what sort of thing? What are we talking here?
So you had, like, nut roasts, or you had, like, chickpea salads, and you have, like, vegetable curries.
It does sound pretty good, though. Yeah, it does sound good.
Vegan sausages.
Nice. And you also did mention to me the other day that, coming back into the real world, let's say, you've felt a bit, not depressed, but it's been a bit of a come down from the whole thing.
Yeah, I've come back down. Because, you honestly, I felt so amazing. The best way I can describe it is, like, you know the night before Christmas when you're a kid, you're super excited, and you kind of have that sense of mystery. I thought when you grew up that you just lose that, but I started getting that just about everyday life, and now it's gone, Ben.
Why do you think it's gone, though? Why can't you achieve that again?
Right, I've slipped back into normal routines and life. You know, I think you can get there in a much slower period, you know, like doing meditation in the morning and evening, but it'll just take much longer. But, like, yeah, that week was just a much deeper practice.
So what you're basically saying is the way we live our modern life, it's not possible to be that happy and that level of, let's say, enlightenment with their air quotes around it.
No, at least not for like a lot of practice. Like, if you spread that amount of practice out, yeah, modern life is not conducive to spiritual development.
Yeah, do you think that's a fundamental problem, though? I mean, if you literally can't do that from day to day, and that is how you enjoy being most, surely that's a...
Yeah, I mean, well, let's be honest. I mean, like, swimming in the loch in the morning, climbing a mountain, meditating all day and eating food, you can't really do that until you're retired, can you? But...
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people, after they do a retreat, make quite drastic life changes to try and get a better work-life balance and, do what they did on the retreat. So do you think you would try it, Ben? Would you go
to the retreat? Try it? No.
And for what reasons?
Oh, there's so many other activities that I like to do. And, you know, everyone works hard, and that when they do get some time off, they have to... When people get time off, they have to spend it wisely, right? I mean, and that just isn't high up on my list of things to do when I get some time off. As simple as that, really.
But do you not feel like a deep sense of discomfort, or like something's missing?
No. In fact, I was thinking recently, life's pretty good at the moment. I mean, you know, there's always underlying issues throughout your life, but life's pretty good for me at the moment.
Oh, you're one of those.
What, happy?
Just everything's going well.
Oh, yeah. Well, what can I say? You know, I can't complain at the moment. So, yeah, if I was to get some time off, it wouldn't be high up on my list. I wouldn't be, like, totally averse to doing it. I think it would be... I don't want to say it would be a laugh, but it would be interesting, to say the least.
I would love to have this podcast conversation, but with the roles reversed.
Yeah.
Do you think you would have as good an experience?
What do you mean?
If you did the retreat, do you think you would have as good a time as I did?
No, because for one, I don't like swimming.
You didn't have to swim.
Well, come on. I mean, if you're right next to the lock, it seems a shame not to, doesn't it? I'm not a swimmer.
Yeah.
And the whole thing you've described with the actual, like, ritual stuff, I couldn't even be in the room for that. I couldn't abide, unfortunately.
Oh, the chants, Ben, the chants.
Yeah, no chance.
Sanskrit's chants.
Yeah.
I thought, none of you know what you're saying. It could just be, like, the guy wrote it, like, we're all losers.
Yeah.
Singing something we don't know.
See, Buddhism, at least in the UK, seems to have this reputation for being quite a modern and... progressive religion. I don't know if that's actually true. I don't know anything about it, so I can't really comment. But so whenever you see things like that, and these ritual traditions that are just kept alive for seemingly just for the sake of it. It always just makes me cringe a little bit inside. I'm reminded of the time we went to Mexico. I think I mentioned on the podcast previous episode. We went to Mexico. I think it was 2 years ago or something like that. Anyway, we went round and one of the places we went to was the cenotes, which are like these big sinkholes that are full of water and you can go swim in them and all this thing. And as part of that, we had to, like, as part of the tour to go do that, we had to go to the little village where these cenotes were. And we had to be blessed by, like, the leader of the village or something like that. And he had this whole ritual thing that he did with, like, incense and burning leaves. And the whole thing just felt so phony. And I was just, like, left stood there thinking, this guy only ever does this when tourists come through. The only thing keeping this alive is tourists. And the whole thing just felt so false.
I wonder if he's committed to the ritual. He can't think it's magical, right?
Well, no, he was wearing a polo shirt, shorts and flip-flops. And I just thought, like... This is just silly. Like, why are we doing this? Why are we keeping this tradition alive? It's on life support. Let's just, you know, pull the plug and let it go into the night.
It's transitioned from a real spiritual thing to a tourist trap.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole thing just felt a bit ugh. And it sounds the same bit with this ritual thing. I quite like the whole idea of being a bit more aware about how you're thinking and how you process the world around you and all that. But then when they start, you know, worshiping the feet of some statue because it symbolizes something or other. I'm just like, no. Let's just stick to the more tangible stuff.
I agree with you. But I changed my mind across the course of the week. Some might call it brainwashing. Some might call it being open-minded.
Oh, man.
Once I started, you know, first of all, you have to think about it in the context of 2,500 years of bolted on cultural attachments, you know?
Yeah.
If you think about it as what it represents, so I was like, right, okay, I'm thinking of fearlessness, and I thought of the idea of fearlessness, and so when I did bow a couple of times. I didn't do it the whole week, and I bowed to myself, and I felt comfortable then, and I was like, okay, I'm not bowing to this weird figure.
I don't think that's too hypocritical though, because it's like with religion and a lot of these holidays that we observe as a country, like, there's a lot of bits of religion that people just make into their own. So, like, certain bits of scripture, certain saints or things like that. It's not necessarily about what it is written to the word in the book. It's more about, well, this is what it means to me, and this is how I conceptualize it and how I make sense of it.
Yeah, and I think there is a little bit too much of that. But I think most modern religions, like Islam and Christianity, kind of, it's quite difficult to contradict the texts. There's plenty, and I agree with people that, you know, reinterpret them in a modern setting, but it's quite difficult to kind of contradict them and, you know, stay part of that faith. But I would say Buddhism has very little in that you need to contradict. It doesn't ask too much of people. You don't need to do anything. You're not going to go to hell. It believes people will die. You know, once you're dead, you're dead.
Yeah.
But it offers kind of a way of, becoming comfortable with that and being happy, you know?
I guess that makes sense. I mean, because if the religion has no sort of sense of ultimate judgment, which, you know, for Christians is heaven, hell and whatnot, then a lot of what it preaches is more open to interpretation, because whether you go by that or you don't go by what they preach, it doesn't really matter, does it? Because ultimately there's no judgment for you. Whereas in religions where there is ultimate judgment, what is being preached is ultimately important and sacrosanct. I mean, you can't go against it.
Yeah, the fact you're being judged makes the words more important, because you're like, okay, I don't want to mess it up.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've solved religion then.
Yeah. Next week, what else are we going to solve? World poverty? World peace? Blimey.
We'll do that now.
No. Let's move on. But I'm glad you had a good week, and welcome back to the real world where things are miserable. You will get wet if you're out in the rain, and
I'm annoyed at slow walkers again. I got back, I checked my messages, and my friend said, he sent me a fart recording and said, welcome back.
Next on the list, I thought I'd just do a quick update, Ed. On a previous episode, I mentioned that Chloe and I were doing our motorbike tests, the real test. I just thought I'd let everyone know I passed, so that's good, isn't it?
Might have a little motorbike sound effect here.
Okay.
So have you, got one? Carry on, Ben.
Have you got one?
You carry. No, you just carry on. Okay. I was surprised
okay,
a bit.
Okay, thanks. I thought so. Yeah, the test was fine. I was massively stressed out, but that was kind of to be expected. I bought a motorbike since. Well, we've bought a motorbike since, and we share it.
Is it good? Do you feel like a bad man?
No, I just enjoy it. I've been using it to go to the office now and then, and it's just a bit more fun than driving a car. It's a bit more, I don't want to say athletic, but there's a bit more, you know.
Are you conscious of the negative stereotypes of motorcyclists, and do you avoid it?
What are the negative stereotypes associated with motorcyclists, though?
Don't know, just being on them.
Just being on them. I think there's like certain sects of motorcyclists, like Harley riders and particular sports bike riders who ride particularly quick around country lanes.
Do you weave between traffic?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, but you're allowed to do that. It is legal. It's in the highway code. You can filter through.
Yeah, but it's cheating, isn't it? Everyone else has to queue.
It does feel particularly good, though. I mean, the other day, there's a particular part on this ride I do where there's a set of traffic lights, and there must have been 40 cars just waiting at the lights, and I just burnt past them all. It felt so good, but that's the advantage to, you know, riding a motorbike. And the disadvantage is, as soon as it rains, you've got no shelter whatsoever, and you get cold and wet. But
and you get sweaty.
You do a bit. So just before I did my test, you know, I was telling you about the Mod 1 exam, which is the one that's on the paddock, and you do all your slalom and figure of eight and all that stuff. Just before I got on the bike to do the test, there was a guy doing his Mod 1 test in the paddock next to where I'd parked my bike. And the guy dropped his bike during the U-turn, and I was just like, oh my God, if that's not a bad omen, what is?
And is that instant failure?
Oh yeah, if you drop your bike during the test, it's an instant fail. But the guy just dropped it on the U-turn, and then he instantly tried to pick it up, and the examiner just like tapped him on the shoulder and was just like, look, mate, just leave it a minute, turn the engine off, have a second, you know as well as I do what's just happened, you need to recoup, and then we'll try and pick this bike up together. And I felt so bad for the guy.
Did he fail?
Oh, yeah, obviously, yeah. If you drop your bike, you definitely fail. Yeah. I do quite like those moments where you observe someone immediately, you know, completely stuffing the situation they're in, and you just get to observe it as a third party.
People that say they don't get a little bit of pleasure from that are liars.
Yeah, exactly. Send them in to @CGTOPod on Twitter. Moving on, just a quick one, Ed. Yeah, just a quick one for you, Ed. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
Signs which say, smile, you're on CCTV. Don't enjoy that. It's a bit passive-aggressive, isn't it?
Do you smile?
No, I don't. Obviously, I don't smile. I just find it's like, it's just saying, you're a criminal. Just smile, because we've got your face now.
Yeah, or Ben, you've tapped into one of my pet hates, which is signs which are trying to be personable.
Yep. Yeah, I hate it.
Or the opposite.
I hate it.
Like, thanks for shopping at Sainsbury's. And you're like, I could be robbing the place.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
So, yeah, just sort of throw that out there.
And I think you were saying this, emails that are like, oops, looks like we made a mistake there.
Yeah,
sorry.
Well, error messages in particular. I hate the ones like from, you're on Google and Gmail breaks and it's like, whoopsie doopsie.
Whoa.
Yeah, I hate those ones. Just let's all be professional here. But yeah, the smile you're on CCTV signs, it really irks me. Anyway, just thought I'd bring that
just
up.
Just give me an error code I can Google. Let me sort it out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, another one for you, Ed, right? Just, I want your opinion on this. Again, this is pretty much a throwaway segment.
Go on, babe. Get out of your system.
Yeah, this really irks me as well. Collective nouns, okay? They're just a lot of bollocks, aren't they?
Whoa. Collective nouns are brilliant.
No, it's just, I hear it. You see it on Twitter so often, like, especially from, like, Twitter accounts, like, Quickopedia, the QI elves, and they're like, a group of polar bears are actually known as a, I don't know, blank insert, but like people say like, oh, a group of crows, they're known as a murder, and it's like, no, they're not, it's a group of crows, no one will go, oh, look at that murder over there, you just get stared at.
I've said a murder of crows.
No, you haven't. No,
just because you're a pleb, Ben, and you don't understand the English language.
The only collective nouns that are used properly are like a herd of sheep or something like that.
All right, Ben, well, we're going to play a game now. I'm going to give you the animal.
Okay.
You have to guess. You can't just say group or herd, right? You have to guess what they are, right? Okay. Beavers.
A battalion or something stupid?
Oh, that's good. That's better than it's colony.
A colony. Yeah, but that's okay. Colony I can get on board with because it's a normal word that you could use in everyday language. But
right, you might have heard this one, but there's four different ones. So you got good spread of, you got a good chance, okay, right? Okay. Cats.
Well, people do say it's like herding cats. So would you call it a herd of cats?
No, you can herd cats. That's the noun.
Yeah, but
not the group.
So they're not collectively known as it wouldn't be a herd of cats.
No. But that sounds terrifying.
What is it then?
It's a clouder or a glaring.
Oh, no, it's not. No, it's not. It's just not, though, is it? it's just a
yeah,
group of cats.
Ben, if I see a group of cats, I'd be, oh, look, there's a clouder of cats over there.
Look, right, if these collective nouns are so important, why aren't they taught at school? At no point do you ever get taught these at school. It's just these stupid throwaway trivia facts that get posted on Twitter. It just really winds me up for some reason.
Maybe herd is just the one that became popular.
Oh, go on, then. What other ones have you got?
Eagles.
A basket of eagles or something stupid, I don't know.
A basket of eagles.
What is it then?
It's a convocation, you fool.
A complication of eagles, are you for real?
A convocation.
A convocation of eagles.
God, Ben, you're where are you from?
Northeast of England.
Yeah, sure, mate. Ferrets.
Ferrets. A ferule of ferrets. I'm just going for alliteration here as well, so.
Business. A business of ferrets.
Oh, no, it's not. It's just not a business.
Flamingos.
Of ferrets. Flamingos. I don't know. I just don't know. I can't even think of anything funny to
a
say.
A basket.
It's not a basket.
A basket of eagles. No. Well, that's got to be the name of the episode.
No, what is, what's the collective noun for eagles? Not eagles, flamingos. What's the collective noun for
a flamboyance?
No, it's not. It's not. It's just not, though, is it? It's not.
What's wrong with it?
It's not a flamboyance. It's not.
All right, I got a good one for
it's
you. Hawks.
Flamingos.
Hawks.
What about them?
What? You see a group of hawks, you think, bloody hell. Look at that, of hawks.
Just tell me, just put me out of my misery.
No, this would be the last one. Yeah, but I like your inventions.
Yeah, go on. Okay, hawks. We're going to be talking like... they're always... Like, a murder of crows just makes no sense at all. Murder is a word. It has a fixed definition. It has nothing to do with
probably
crows.
Probably from that film from that old fella.
What?
What's that one? Birds.
The Birds. Alfred Hitchcock.
That man. That's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go on. What's the collective word for hawks?
A kettle.
No, it's not. It's just not. Who would ever say that? Have you ever, genuinely, ever seen anyone say, oh, look at that kettle of hawks over there? Have you ever heard anyone say that?
I think you should write, not with hawks. No, but I've never seen more than one hawk, so who knows? it could be in waiting. Someone's waiting to say that. Have you seen more than one hawk?
The only thing holding you back from using that word is the fact that you've never seen more than one in an area at once.
Right, man. I think you should write a strongly worded letter to Oxford Dictionary.
It really irks me. But anyway, let's move on. So you and I both recently climbed Snowdon as well.
Yeah, it was good.
And that's the end of the podcast, folks. Thanks for tuning in.
Tell you what disappointed me, though. Yeah. I thought Snowdon, tallest mountain in Wales. That sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Really, really tall. And then I looked at the list of top 100 mountains, and it's, like, really low down. It's, like, 70th.
Wait. Is it even in the top 100 mountains? Top 100 mountains of what?
Of the United Kingdom?
No, don't give me that. It's got to be quite high up there.
Nah.
You're talking absolute rubbish.
They're all in Scotland. It's like saying, you know, when you're like, you're the top of the worst PE set. You're like, I'm the best in my PE set. It's like, yeah, but you're in the bottom PE set.
Maybe you said that.
Wales. Wales is the bottom PE set.
Top
Snowdon's the best kid.
UK mountains. Okay, let's have a look. List of mountains of the British Isles by height.
Okay. Yeah, I reckon it's about 67th.
Oh my goodness.
Where is it, Ben?
That is amazing. I did not know that. Wow.
You, yeah. You, we've
don't all
feel so good now,
new.
Do you?
We've all learned something new today. Okay, so I've got the list. This is on Wikipedia. It'll be in the show notes. This is Sims by Height.
Whoever can guess the position of Snowden,
you've already
gets
said
a fiver from Ben.
You've already said.
What, 67th?
76th.
Oh, well, same, potatoes, potatoes, yeah. You know?
But that, so of the top 100, like, the vast, vast majority of these are Scotland, like, by far. I guess that, they don't call it the Highlands for
just
nothing.
Selfish, taking them all.
Yeah. Wow, I didn't know that. I don't think England's even got any on this list. Oh, England, 257.
Well, I felt really good after Snowdon.
So Scafell Pike is 257th highest mountain of the British Isles.
Does it just barely qualify?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's mad.
Are you ready for another great metaphor from me?
Go on.
Right? It's like qualifying for the Olympics when you're in one of those countries that only has like 2,000 people. That's what Scafell Pike is.
Yeah, yeah, I suppose.
It's like the Jamaican bobsleigh team.
Hey, you don't say anything bad about the Jamaican bobsleigh team.
I'm not. They were great, but they were from Jamaica.
This list's crazy. It's all just Scotland.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Did you enjoy Stone and Ben?
Yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it. The view from the top was horrific because the cloud base is often lower than Snowdon itself, so we couldn't see anything at the top. And another thing as well, when you get to the top, when you got there,
was it the crowds?
Was there a queue to get to the actual peak?
Yes,
oh,
there were about 200 people queuing for selfies. So I said to my friend, I was like, right, bugger this. We want to technically get to the top. So we ran up, tapped it, and ran off again because we didn't really care about the photo. We just wanted to do it.
Yeah, it was one of the most British sights I've ever seen. At the top of a mountain, people were queuing to get to the actual peak. And the actual peak, for people who don't know, the actual peak of Snowdon, it's kind of like man-made. It's kind of constructed, right? It's a big pile of like rubble. Am I right in that?
I think so, yeah. But and it's just like, a little platform on top.
Yeah. So Chloe just ran up the side and I just stood at the bottom. I didn't care about the extra 5 metres or whatever. I mean...
Did you find that really depressing, though?
Well, if people want to say I haven't actually climbed Snowdon, go for it. I don't care. But, yeah. Actually, have you seen... in Norway, in all the fjords, there's a particularly famous one, which is like a platform that goes right, juts out, right into the fjord, and it's like a massive drop around it. I can't remember what it's called.
Not familiar. Sounds cool though.
Thor's Norway. What's it called? There it is. What do you call that? Oh no, I was completely wrong. It's called Trolltunga, which I think is troll's tongue. I'm not sure though. I don't speak Norwegian. But anyway, if you Google that picture, Trolltunga, have you got a picture of it?
Yeah.
So what you don't see whenever people take pictures on Trolltunga is that there's usually, after a massive hike up there, there's a big old queue just off to the left of the camera where people queue. In fact, there is a picture on Google Images there where you can see the queue of people trying to get on Trolltunga to get a picture taken.
You know what's the worst thing, though? Like, on the one hand, it's really depressing. You're like, oh my God, all these people here. But on the other hand, you're part of it.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm also the part of the problem.
Yeah, but what can you do? I mean, tourism's becoming more and more widespread across the globe. I mean, we've got countries like China, which historically didn't have many tourists leaving the country and visiting other places. And now anyone can get a low-price holiday package to go abroad. So there's going to be fewer and fewer of these untouched, amazing places left out there. The world's only so big and there's so many people now.
What a shame that we can all experience the natural beauty of the world.
Yeah, yeah.